Hello, friends. Before we begin, I just want to say that in this episode we talk about various gnarly things, including under the umbrella of violence against women, including some mention of rape. And if that doesn't sound like something you want to listen to, just skip this one. Hello, friends. Bet you haven't heard that for a while.
We're back, baby.
We are back. It me, Bethany Rutter. I'm here with my good friend and business partner.
It me, Alice Slater.
This is, what page are you on?
Back on the horse.
Yeah, it has been a very long time, but we did have a lot going on.
So basically, we were going to take a little summer holiday, as is our will.
Yes.
And then you were moving house.
You were going on
I went on my
honeymoon.
little honeymoon to Japan. Highly recommend it. Good time had by all.
Yes.
Rained a lot.
But what can you do? It was a typhoon.
Yeah,
It
it was a
was,
typhoon.
yeah, the most rain that is possible. Yeah, and then that kind of resolved itself a couple of weeks ago, and now we're back.
Now we're back. Back up and at 'em, ready to shine, coming from
Yep,
a
key
very special place.
difference. Yes, we are no longer always going to be recording in our homes. We are coming at you live, not live, from Clean Prose.
Which is a writing centre in London. Clean Prose is like a co-working space for writers. They do loads of classes, talks and lectures, seminars, workshops, as well as providing space for writers to work in. We are both founding members,
Yep.
which is why we are here.
This isn't necessarily kind of sponsored by them, but they are aiding. They're enabling
Exactly.
us. So we don't get like money or anything. Like they're not paying us to promote them, but we are using Clean Prose to record in.
So I
And they're
guess
very,
like
very good eggs.
every time we're here, we will mention that as a
Yeah.
thank you.
Because they are so good. So something cool happened between our last episode and this episode, which is a great book was reissued, and that is the book we're going to talk about today.
It's like the weirdest intro. I had no
Yeah,
idea
I know,
what
I
you were
could see
gonna
your face. You were
say.
like, oh,
I
what's
was
she
like,
going to say?
wait, what
What's going on?
happened?
Well, In the Cut by Susanna Moore was reissued on Halloween, the most auspicious day of the year. And we're going to talk about it in this episode today because we have both read it and we both. How do we feel?
We loved it.
We both love it.
We loved it. Loved it. Still love it. Yesterday, today, tomorrow. Had you read it first time around?
I had not read it first time around, but I saw the film.
Me too.
Yes.
What did you think? Okay, let's just hop right in. What did you think of it?
I loved it. I loved this work. I love this
Yeah.
work. I loved it. It is probably one of my faves of the year. If it was a new book this year, it would automatically become one of my faves of the year. Like, love it.
I think it's really interesting that, so it was written in the 90s, right?
Yep.
It feels very timeless.
Yeah, I
It doesn't feel
agree.
like a book of the 90s in the way that some books may kind of age a little.
Brettys and Alice.
Yeah, cough, our man
Yeah.
BEE.
Yeah, I agree. So it's from 1995. So it's really quite old
How old
in
were you
terms
in
of I
1995?
was 6 years old.
Aww.
Possibly at my cutest.
I was 9, so really just getting started.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Beginning your journey towards becoming the tofu that you are today. So tell us about In the Cut.
Okay, so
She takes a sip of water.
just to prepare my,
Yeah.
moisten my mouth, ready to articulate this plot. Okay, so basically, I use the word articulate on purpose because there's a very strange use of the word disarticulate,
Yeah.
which we will come to later. In the Cut is about a teacher living in New York in the 1990s. She is in a bar one night. She goes looking for the bathroom, opens the wrong door, and stumbles upon a man whose face is completely hidden in shadow, receiving a blowjob from a
Yes.
lady who later turns up dead.
Later the same day.
Later
So
that
almost
same
similar,
night.
it was almost all part of the same experience.
Yeah. Franny, the main character, speaks to the detective who's conducting the investigation regarding the murder of this woman. She speaks to him on several occasions about the night in question. Like
What she can
she
remember
was
and
seen in the bar, so she's kind of not so much a person of interest, but she's a key, potentially a key witness. And it kind of goes from there.
It does.
He uses the phrase disarticulated to describe what happens to the woman's body, which I think is the weirdest use of the word disarticulated, the weirdest way, the weirdest clinical way to describe violence.
Yeah, to describe like someone's limbs being removed from their body, right?
Disarticulated.
That's, yeah. That's what it. Yeah. So yeah, basically in a nutshell, that is the plot.
So it's very violent.
Yeah, it is.
Did you find the violence gratuitous?
No. Not really. I don't know. I don't know. It didn't, like, trouble me.
I mean, I guess maybe gratuitous is the wrong word to use. Because I feel like it's appropriate.
Yeah.
But it is so fucking much.
Yeah.
Like, it's one of the most violent books that I've ever read.
Yeah, and yet, I don't know. It didn't kind of... Maybe I respond... Maybe there's, like, a certain kind of violence that freaks me out, and this wasn't it. But, yeah. It is very dark and very nasty.
What did you think of the relationship between Franny and her student, Cornelius?
That's a big question. What do you think of it?
I don't know. I'm trying to get the discussion going. I thought it was really interesting. So Franny as a character is quite kind of closed off. She only really has one friend.
Pauline,
not Patricia, as I erroneously called her before we started recording. She only really has one friend. She doesn't really date. She doesn't really spend much time with people. And this student takes a real interest in her.
He sort of insinuates himself into her. He's like a puppy, and he won't really leave her alone, but not necessarily in a kind of like threatening man way.
No, and I think that's the thing about their relationship is that she obviously wants to maintain an appropriate boundary, but also, you know, he shows up in moments when she's very vulnerable and actually really needs someone. So the boundary is kind of crossed repeatedly. Obviously, at one point, the boundary is no longer a boundary. It is like a mere memory of a boundary.
Yeah.
But throughout the book, like, she keeps kind of towing this line between what is and isn't appropriate, which I thought was really interesting. I really enjoyed.
I agree. And that's kind of what the whole book is about, is, like, how close can you safely allow yourself to get to men? I don't know. That's, for me, one of the questions of In the Cup.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That it's definitely a theme, is, like, how far you can trust men that you don't really know.
Yeah. And how well can you know men when they are capable of extreme violence? You are not a watcher of The Sopranos, are you?
I'm not a watcher of The Sopranos. I go as far as to say I've had absolutely no contact with The Sopranos whatsoever.
So there's a Sopranos episode that is one of my favourites, which is called Employee of the Month. And the central conceit of The Sopranos is that it is about this mafia boss, Tony Soprano, and he is in therapy with a therapist called Jennifer. And at the beginning of this episode, Jennifer is raped by someone that she doesn't know in the stairwell of the car park where she parks her car when she's at work. And she does find out who it was, and kind of the episode is almost about whether she tells Tony Soprano, who is a very dangerous man, who did this to her, knowing that if he knew, he would probably kill him. And that is, I thought about that episode a lot while I was reading this book, because it's about, like, proximity to powerful / dangerous men, and whether you know them well or whether you don't, whether they are themselves the dangerous one, or, I don't know. I like them both as this kind of, like, rubbing up against danger and power.
Yeah, and, like, if they're capable of one thing, why shouldn't they be capable of another?
Yes, because one of the key questions in the cut is the person who murdered this woman the policeman with whom she is having a growing relationship?
Because that's the thing, isn't it? She doesn't tell, in the first interview with the police officer, she doesn't tell him what she saw. She doesn't reveal that she saw this woman have sex or giving this guy head. I think specifically, I can't remember if she expresses it or if it's just like a kind of glossed over. Like, I can't really remember. But there is this vibe that she doesn't want to share this intimate thing that she saw because she doesn't want she doesn't want the investigation to change direction, right? Like, she's worried that of the men will take it less seriously. The men investigating will maybe take it less seriously or look at the whole thing through a different lens if they think that she was, you know, sexually promiscuous.
Yeah.
But also there is a question as to whether or not the man that she is talking to was in fact the man receiving the blowjob.
Who then we assume killed her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And something that I loved about the book was that, you know, like when you have seen a film or even that you know that a film exists of a book that you're reading, whether or not you've seen it, if you know the cast, it's really easy to just imagine the people that you're reading as the actors from the adaptation. And for whatever reason, even though I've seen the film, I didn't imagine Franny as Meg Ryan. I didn't imagine Malloy as Mark Ruffalo. Like, that just did not happen for me.
Neither, but then I think that's might be for me because I saw the movie like over 10 years ago.
Yeah, I don't know. Even so, I'm still like I've never watched the TV adaptation of one of my favorite books, Crimson Petal and the White. But I just it never comes to my mind that any of the people that were cast in it actually occupy that character in my brain. I don't know.
I think generally I'm quite good at separating the two.
Trampling down on the memory of who those people were played by. Yeah.
Yeah, like I generally, like, it doesn't bother me too much. But then I guess I don't tend to hop between, like, a book and movie multiple times. So maybe if I've seen the movie first, maybe that will affect how I read characters. But I don't know.
Yeah. No, I felt there was something so kind of powerfully itself about the book that it nothing about the film really had kind of polluted my imagination. And I really like that. It's such a strange, weird, inscrutable little book.
It really is. Like, the texture of the writing is very unique.
Yeah.
Like, she is writing a book collecting slang. And so every now and again, the narrative is interrupted with these, like, lists of words. Let me see if I can find one at random. Yeah, here we go. I have new words for the dictionary. To knock boots, phrase. To have sexual intercourse. Track, noun. Contract, as in, I got a track to kill him. It's, like, very kind of... it made me think of Attrib.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's, like, very...
People who are interested in words and acquiring words.
And I enjoy it because, like, obviously, like, this isn't her, it's not her language, it's not her voice.
Yeah.
So she's listening out, she listens to students, she listens to people in bars, she picks these words up from the city that she lives in, which I really enjoyed. What did you think, no spoilers, what did you think of the ending?
I love the ending. And if you have seen the film, it is different in the book. So that's, like, the key difference between the two versions of this tale. I actually am, you know, when I think about it, I'm pretty, like, bummed that they changed the ending for the film. And obviously we can't really talk about too much why that bums me out without spoiling the ending of this book. And this is a very, like, what page are you on book. So I feel like if you haven't already picked this up off the back of it being reissued a couple of weeks ago, I hope this episode inspires you to pick it up.
Yeah, so I guess we'll leave the ending
chat there. But
For me, it has to end the way that it does.
Yeah.
But it is, and it's one of the best endings, I feel, of any book that I've read in a really long time. Like, for me, a good ending has to make you want to start from the beginning again.
Yeah.
You know? Like, it needs to leave. It shouldn't feel like a full stop. You need to be reeling a little bit.
It's so disconcerting. It's so, like, it really is, like, a troubling ending. And it's so good for being that way.
I want to know if at any point the author, Susanna Moore, not the same Susanna Moore who writes for The Guardian. Important to note.
Yeah.
I wonder if at any point anyone tried to change her mind on that ending. Or I wonder if she ever flip-flopped about how to end this book.
And then, like, because she was involved in adapting it for the film. So why did they then change the ending for the film?
Hollywood, innit?
Idiots. Damn fools, the lot of them.
But I actually read an interview with her today in kind of just researching, reading the background about the book for this episode. And she said that she doesn't believe in happy endings. Don't believe in them.
And interesting. I quite like that. Yeah.
It's like, good for you.
Good for you, Susanna. What else has she written?
I have no idea. Yeah. I cannot stress how ignorant I am.
But it's weird that, you know, we are like ladies who read books, and yet, I mean, if this hadn't been reissued, I probably wouldn't have read it.
But this is what fucking happens, though. Like, books just drop off the radar.
Yeah.
And especially, you know, you can have books that were shortlisted for major prizes, but if they didn't win, they're gone.
R.I.P. Like,
and it's a shame. It is a real shame. Like, I think we're so kind of obsessed with what the next big thing is. It's very rare to go back into the depths of, you know, the literary archive of even the last fucking 10 years. I don't know. Stuff just drops below the surface. And it's a shame, because, like, how do you know what's good?
Yeah, and it's interesting that even something that has, like, a Hollywood adaptation, that doesn't guarantee its place in our memory or people reading it. And, yeah, what can you do?
I also wonder as well if, because this book is, it's, like, it's really, like, erotic and it's really violent. I wonder if it maybe struggled to find its feet.
Well, speaking of how erotic and violent it is, the film of this was the catalyst for the iconic bad, the quintessential bad chat show interview between Michael Parkinson and Meg Ryan. He hated the film so much that when he interviewed her on Parkinson, have you never seen this?
No.
It's so bad. Like, he clearly really hated the film. He hated it. Probably because it was sexy and violent. And he just couldn't, like, play the game. And he couldn't just interview her. Like, they clearly just were never going to get on. But he did not help. And I was talking about this the other day with someone. And I really think if that happened now, it would be perceived quite differently. And I think it would be perceived more as, like, this old white guy not wanting to engage with something that isn't, like, for and about him. And we'd be like, good for her. Rather than, like, oh, she's kind of prickly. And, I'm, you know, I don't know whether she's a particularly, like, nice and friendly person, but I just think that the adaptation of this book provokes someone to such, like, almost an inability to do their own job because they found it so, like, troubling.
Oh, man.
Yeah. You should watch it. It is very awkward.
I will. I love watching awkward car crash interviews where men are terribly behaved.
Yeah. So, in general, one of the reasons that we wanted to do this, talk about this book in particular, was something has arisen over the past couple of years that we disapprove of. I will go on the record and say, what page are you on? Disapproves of.
We're not fans.
We're not fans of the Staunch Prize.
So if you haven't heard of the Staunch Prize, it is a literary prize for crime fiction, as described by them in their own words as championing novels in the thriller genre in which no woman is beaten, stalked, sexually exploited, raped, or murdered. Which sounds, I think, good on paper.
Noble. A noble desire.
And obviously, like, I totally understand people who enjoy and want to read crime fiction but do not want to read
rape and murder.
Yeah, like violence against women over and over again. And I think there's a lot of really interesting conversations to be had around who gets to tell those stories, how we tell them, whether or not they're helpful, like, what is a good, you know, what's helpful to include and what isn't. There's lots of really interesting conversations to have. I don't feel like the prize promotes those conversations, though.
Not at all.
And I don't feel, if I remember correctly, I don't think it even comes from a place of love for the genre.
It's almost like a punitive thing.
Yeah.
I think that's what I find the most troubling about it, is that, like, I don't know how to explain it, but those books, you know, books that kind of explore all of these terrible things that can happen to women, I don't think they're part of the problem. I just feel like they're a symptom of something, but I don't think that by rewarding books that don't do it, it's so profoundly unhelpful. And I just don't feel like people that are serious crime writers, serious crime readers, lovers of the genre, people who are involved in it, I can't really see, like, the motivation behind it.
And I think it was Val McDermid that said, I will stop writing about violence against women when it stops happening.
Yeah, like, I just, who thinks this is a good idea, that like, or who thinks that it's not like you can prevent this from happening by preventing people from writing about it. I cannot fathom it at all. And it's almost like saying this exists because of books like this, rather than trying to...
So what they're specifically saying is that... hang on, I just found a great quote about it. They're saying that it's perpetuates the idea that most instances of violence against women are by strangers. So fictional stereotypes of night stalkers, dark alley attackers, serial killers, and menacing strangers are dangerously misleading when 90% of rapists are known to the victim and the majority of women murdered knew their killer. This can seriously affect justice for women, to say the least, and must be addressed. For these reasons, and because we love great writing, we invite thriller writers to bring us strong stories that don't resort to the same old cliches. I find that just intrinsically flawed. It's just flawed. The argument is that by writing about fictional stereotypes of night stalkers, dark alley attackers, serial killers, and menacing strangers is dangerously misleading. That's a small fraction of the kind of thrillers that I read. Like, I mostly read psychological thrillers in which the
perpetrator is always the husband.
It's always the fucking husband or the boyfriend or the neighbor.
And then also it's like, so I'll Be Gone in the Dark, for example, which is about repeated sustained instances of violence against women by someone who is not known to them. What do we say about that? Like, is that just like irrelevant because it is not representative of like what they perceive to be a reality? Like,
or is it harmful?
Yeah.
Because that's the crux of it is it harmful? Is In the Cut harmful? No, it fucking isn't. It's not harmful. What she's doing is talking about violence in a way that is scary and alarming and disconcerting. It's not harmful.
I just can't get my head around why they decided that this was the solution. This solution phrased in this particular way. It's also, like, really disrespectful to women writers who want to, like, work through their own experiences. Like, why is that suddenly seen as somehow, like, taboo or, like, unsisterly or whatever? If you are a female crime writer that wants to kind of explored this stuff in that way,
writing through trauma,
and also like that, you know, their goal may be to kind of rebalance the scales of what we perceive to be like the reality of violence against women, but that, you know, the prize doesn't say, you know, it, the rules of the prize are no woman is beaten, stalked, sexually exploited, raped or murdered, like that.
So there is basically, by what they're doing is, I think, removing any potential conversation. Like, I don't, tell me, just explain the value to me of awarding a man a prize for writing a crime book in which mostly focuses on men. So what does that have to do with violence against women? Yeah. How does that help women? Now, I'm not saying that man shouldn't write that book. He absolutely should. I'm not saying he shouldn't win prizes for it. It's great. Of course he should. But for me, it's just fucking irrelevant. Yeah. It's not actually relevant to the conversation of violence against women.
And I also think there are conversations to be had about why we find media containing violence against women more compelling than violence against men. I think that's like an interesting thing to talk about. Like, would Twin Peaks have existed if it was about a man? Like, if, you know, Laura Palmer was a guy, like, I don't think that would have had the same kind of...
Or a black woman.
Yeah. Also, what kind of women are we talking about?
Exactly.
I just think there's so many interesting conversations to be had around, like, victims of crime and how we perceive them and how we talk about them. But this is, like, the least interesting way of working that out.
And also, I think that in terms of conversations about what is generally considered stereotypical and not helpful in the kind of crime thriller genre, Lauren Bukes, who wrote The Shining Girls, she says of that book, right, that one of the things she was most interested in was getting, like, kind of obliterating the Hannibal Lecter serial killer. So the suave, intelligent man who...
Charming,
wealthy, for all intents and purposes, you could, excuse the pun, sit down to dinner with him and not notice anything was awry, right? The other thing she's really interested in was not just writing about the beautiful victim. And I saw her do this incredible talk at Latitude Festival, where she talked about the, like huge number, she's a South African writer, the huge number of missing persons that are young black women that go completely under the radar, whereas missing white women statistically are way more likely to get press coverage, way more likely to get talked about. And that she recognises those patterns in fiction, that you're way more likely to have a beautiful young white woman on a slab on a missing persons poster at the crux of a crime story than anyone else from any other demographic. That is fucking interesting.
Yeah.
And that's worth talking about. I think focusing, if you're going to talk about cliches in the crime genre and just focusing on this idea of strangers, I'm not sure that that's someone who reads very much crime fiction.
Yeah.
TBH.
TBQH. What do you think, friends at home? Are you into this? I would assume as readers of what the kind of books that we like, which is what I kind of assume that our listeners are by virtue of being our listeners, that probably not on board with it. But I'm interested because, yeah, like, you know, I know at least one author who I otherwise admire and like who has kind of spoken out in favour of this prize. So it's not kind of beyond the realms of possibility that people do not agree with us. So, yeah, come forward. Bring your thoughts to us.
Please do. And I'm especially interested in people who are pro the prize. I'd love to know how much digging you've done about the prize itself. Because to me, on paper, it sounds fine. It's not for me, but it sounds fine. But the more I read about it, the less I felt that it was coming from a place of celebrating
crime fiction.
Crime fiction. It feels like it's someone wagging their finger at all the naughty crime writers.
You know who I'm thinking about? I'm thinking about there's an author that is very like judgmental of like crime stuff that I'm thinking about. I'll tell you later.
Tell me after the show.
I will. But no, there's you know, there's just like someone who's always very kind of like school mistressy about this kind of thing.
Three authors you could be talking about.
Three lady
two
authors.
Two of which have written crime books.
Well, we'll talk about this off the record.
One of which we will be discussing in the next episode.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Great. What are you reading right now?
Okay, so I'm glad you asked. I am reading for an event on Tuesday, Irenasin Okoje's new collection. It's called Nudie Branch. It is just so good. It's like hot and violent and wild and strange, and she just has the most brilliant brain.
And she's also a founder member of Clean Prose. And she's right a founder member of Clean Prose. And she's just like a cool person.
She's very cool. I love her writing so much, and I've been so excited to get my hands on this. So I'm loving that. I'm also listening to the audiobook, like everyone else on the internet, of The Secret History, being narrated by Donna Tartt herself.
What a treat.
I just love it so much.
Even though I don't feel like a burning desire to revisit the book, I think I will maybe use my next Audible credit on it.
Honestly, I don't think that you could do wrong.
Yeah, I know. I will love it. And as we all know, because I keep telling people, you can return Audible books if you don't like them.
Yeah,
so
that's
yeah,
her passion.
Yeah, my passion is
getting her money back. Damn it!
Yeah, getting my credits worth at Audible.
And what are you reading, Bert?
Bert is reading a absolute banger in written form, and listening to an absolute banger in Audible form, slightly more controversial. The written banger is "You Will Know Me" by Megan Abbott, the gymnastics one. yeah, it's so good.
I freaking love Megan Abbott.
She is literally
so
perfect.
Much.
Like Megan Abbott, I feel like if there was a like literary patronus of what page are you on, I do feel like Megan Abbott best synthesizes everything that we like and that we both like.
Yeah.
Because there's stuff that I'm really into that you're not so into, but I feel like she really does
the
it all.
The Venn diagram of our passions.
Yeah.
That overlapping section is just Megan Abbott.
It's just, she's so good. So this one is about gymnastics. And all of her books are kind of about, like, women and secrets and violence.
Girls.
Yeah.
Yeah, lots of teenagers, lots of best friends, lots of tension.
Betrayal and the like.
Have you seen the stills from the TV show of Demi yet?
No.
Fuck me. I've only seen one still, and it's this, like, moody-looking 90s goth cheerleader with a little choker on and some dark brown lipstick.
It could be more you if it tried.
I am living.
Yeah.
I can't fucking wait. I mean, I know myself and I probably won't watch it, but still, I'm just so excited it exists.
Because it's TV.
Only because I don't know how to get that. Like, I don't know what channel it's going to be on. Do you know what I mean? Like,
we did okay with Shrill. We went there.
Yeah, we found it.
With the help
it.
Of your brother. Yeah. With the technical expertise of your bro. And on Audible, I am listening to... Okay, I think she is, like, the worst person in the world, and I hate her.
Okay.
But oh my God. I really... I can't remember what it was.
What are you going to come out with?
Oh, yes. So one of my favourite podcasts is called You're Wrong About. And it's where two people chat about a, like, cultural phenomenon or a story or, like, a person that they feel was, like, not really accurately represented at the time. I listened to the episode about Columbine, and that made me really want to revisit We Need to Talk About Kevin by Lionel Shriver.
Whew!
And
all right.
I know that Lionel Shriver is, like, a horrible, horrible, horrible person. Yeah. I would never, ever want to, like, be in the same room as her, let alone read any of her other books.
Agreed.
But We Need to Talk About Kevin really bangs.
It's a stone cold banger.
It's so good and it's so interesting. It's just, it really is incredibly, like, thought provoking. So on the one hand, I think it's, like, amazing. But on the other hand, having listened to a lot of You're Wrong About, where the hosts, especially the female host, Sarah Marshall, really encourages this kind of, like, radical empathy. That's, like, the opposite of We Need to Talk About Kevin, where the narrative is basically that, like, he was evil and malicious from birth, and it really it's been interesting listening to it from that angle. So with this new info that I have,
interests me, because something that I've wondered, I read We Need to Talk About Kevin years and years and years ago, and I have wondered whether reading it now, knowing more about Lionel Shriver's fucking appalling
evil
politics,
yeah,
I wondered if I would read the book differently, or there might be red flags in there that I missed as a young woman, less aware of the politics of the world as I am today. I just wondered if there's anything in it that would make me wince now.
I don't know if it's so much wince as just, like, it does... yeah, it remains an interesting book. It's not, like, kind of ideologically perfect, but I just feel like it has so much interesting stuff in it, particularly reading it from the point of view of someone who explicitly and specifically and forever and ever will not want children. Like, yeah. From that point of view, it's very interesting. But it's also, like, incredibly extreme. You know, it is a book about a woman who doesn't really want to have children, who ends up having children, and it ends in, like, the worst possible way. So it almost, you could read it as, like, this is what happens when people who don't want to have children, and you can pass on that, like, antipathy for your child to your child. I don't know. There's a lot going on there, but I just think it's such a gripping book, and she really knocked it out of the park, and in a way that I never hear people talking about her other books.
It's, well, yeah, I mean, it's truly, it's the book that made her. She may as well not have written anything else, because who cares, to be perfectly frank. I would never be that rude about an author.
If they were not pure evil.
Just hate her, yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think it's this incredible nature versus nurture story, the plot of which, there are several plot points in that fucking book that made me gasp out that.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. So, that's that.
Okay, one more thing that I wanted to talk to you about on this episode.
Oh, yes.
Just quickly, something that we haven't had the opportunity to discuss on the record. What did you think of the Man Booker Prize this year?
You know what I think about the Man Booker Prize this year, my good bitch. I'm very unimpressed. I'm really unimpressed.
Yeah.
I feel like we are in agreement on why we are unimpressed, which is that prizes can change people's lives, and I don't believe that it will change Margaret Atwood's life, and I especially don't believe that in a year where the other winner is the first black woman to ever win it, it is appropriate to share that with an incredibly well-established, well-supported, and well-financed old white lady. I just don't believe it. I'm really not happy about it. And I'm even less happy about it, having seen all these pictures from bookshops literally around the country with their Man Booker Prize winner tables, which have, like, 50 copies of The Testaments, and then, like, 3 copies of Girl, Woman, Other, which I assume isn't because they are selling them in enormous quantities.
No,
and they can't.
The reason for that, I can tell you why that is. It will not be because
individual bookshops making bad choices.
Yeah, it will be that, well, not even that. It would be nothing to do with the prize itself. All of those photos will have come from the immediate aftermath of the announcement, where there is no fucking way any bookshop will have had multiple copies of the more obscure titles on the list. I use the word obscure very fucking loosely, because obviously Bernardine Evaristo is not an obscure writer. She has fucking loads of books under her belt. But none of the books on the list had the same fanfare as Atwood did when her book came out. Every shop would have been overstocked to fuck. They would have printed so many copies knowing that it was going to be one of the biggest commercial successes of the year. The fact that every book had tables left over shows that perhaps, potentially, it wasn't selling as hard as it was supposed to. Mm. It also could just be that, regardless of who won the prize, they were not going to be taking down Atwood displays. Yeah. They were expecting to sell that solidly throughout Christmas.
And that no other winner would have been bought in the same quantities as Margaret Atwood, whoever it was.
Yeah, the problem, I think, though, is that it's fucking embarrassing, and booksellers who are leaving their displays like that, that was a mistake.
Yeah.
What you need to do is you need to put together a better table. You
contemplate
know?
The optics, my dude.
Just sort it.
Yeah. So those are my feelings. Yeah, I don't have many others. I normally say those are my feelings, I have others, but really I have explained almost all of my feelings about that decision.
It just felt a little bit spineless. Yeah. I just feel like, you know what, just say it with your chest. Yeah. Pick the best book. Pick the winner.
Well, I just don't... Was it literally because Margaret Atwood would go to the ceremony that they had to give her the... Like, why? I don't understand.
I don't know. I would absolutely love to have been a little fly on the wall and overhear the discussion between the judges. I don't know. I don't want to be so cynical that I would imagine there was some kind of practical reason, you know? Like, I hope that the judges were free to make their own decision. I just think no one wanted to not award it to Atwood.
Oh, disgusting. Especially, I just think, in the year after Milkman, where you saw what that did for Anna Burns, like, you saw how that changed her life, like, how, what impact it had on this, like, this book. I just think it's absurd. Like, when you, as a prize, have been able to witness firsthand the impact that your prize can have on the, like, life and career and work of an author, to give it to someone who is going to have that same career whatever happens, versus, like, really celebrating someone who might not.
I think the thing is, though, as well, at the end of the day, the Booker Prize is awarded for an individual work.
Not a career.
It is not for a career. It is not for who the author is. It's not for what the book is in context of anything else. Like,
it's one book.
It's awarded for one work. If the Testaments really earned it, and I don't know, I haven't read it yet. I'm not truly that excited to read it, if I'm perfectly honest. I feel like the reviews that I've seen have implied that you need to have watched the TV show for it to make any sense.
That's absurd.
Yeah, but I mean, more than one person has said that to me, and the thought of a sequel to a book like The Handmaid's Tale, which, for the record, I think is incredible and I really love. I haven't watched the TV show. I don't really watch that much, like, serious television. So I probably will never watch it. So the idea of the sequel of the book hinging on a TV show that is now four series deep.
That's wild.
Like, fuck off. I don't have time for that.
And also, you know, maybe this is getting, like, too gnarly in the politics of it, but I do think there's something kind of up with, like, rewarding, you know, at the expense of a black woman, rewarding a white woman who's created a dystopia out of the realities of things that do and have happened to black women, which is essentially what Margaret Atwood did with The Handmaid's Tale.
Ouch. In other book-related news, I am very honoured to be editing a short story collection with... What the fuck, hey?
I thought I was far enough away from
the
microphone.
Can you fucking believe... You know what, Bethany? You take my breath away.
I'm thirsty.
You take my... You know what? I'm thirsty for justice. Throw that water away.
Down my throat.
Okay, so yeah, I'm editing an anthology with Three of Cups Press. I just dropped the lineup on, like, early November. I'm really proud. I'm really excited. I've got 9 authors so far, including Irena Sinekoje, Ellie Williams, Julia Armfield, Leonie Ross, Alexia Arthurs, Anna Wood, Savat Hassan, and probably some other great people.
Loads of great people.
Just loads of them. So you can pre-order that at threeofcups.com/outsiders, or you can check my Twitter feed, because I'm talking about it constantly. I'm really jazzed. So cheers.
And do pre-order it. It makes a real... The pre-order especially for
aspect is super important because we're not doing a Kickstarter. It's the first time this micro press has released a book just on the back of pre-orders. So I feel very honoured, but really scared because that's a big deal.
Yeah, it's a lot of pressure.
A lot of pressure on my small shoulders.
But I believe that your loyal friends and fans will come through and will pre-order.
You know, it's not even about me. Because the authors authors themselves are incredible. Their reputation alone should get you jazzed.
So we can be found on the internet at whatpagepod on twitter.com.
And on Instagram.
Also at whatpagepod.
Yeah.
Well, we do need to re-record where we can be found on the internet because some of us have shed our skin like a chameleon. That's not what they do. Like a snake.
Snakes do. I don't want to call myself a snake. I think of myself more like a phoenix.
A cute little snake.
I set fire to the Good House smoking tofu, and I am now at Alice MJ Slater.
On twitter.com.
That's M for mother, or in my case, Mary. That's
not what the M is for. Alice mother Jane Slater.
Jean.
I'm so sorry. Okay, so you're Alice MJ Slater on Twitter.
On Instagram, however, I'm still smoking tofu.
The phoenix is still in its embers.
She's halfway.
Yeah. I am at Bethany Rutter on Twitter, and I am at Bethany _Rutter on Instagram, because Bethany Rutter, whoever the hell she is, who I hope has been being tagged non-stop in pictures of No Big Deal and is getting annoyed about it and should just give me her username, she has it on Instagram.
Well, good for her.
Yeah. We will...
Catch you next time.
Bye. Bye.